Welcome to The Independent with Scott Atlas, brought to you by The Independent Institute, my show that tries to bring a uniquely rational perspective to some of today's most controversial issues. Today's guest is Donald Boudreau. Don is a senior fellow with the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center, which is at George Mason University. He's a professor of economics there, and he holds the Martha and Nelson Getchell Chair for the Study of Free Market Capitalism at the Mercatus Center. Don and I have a conversation about free market economics, especially relating with Hayek's fundamental points from almost 100 years ago now to what we see in America today, and its relevance to the most important point of economic freedom. That is, it's the basis for all freedoms in America today. Thanks for joining us and stay tuned. Welcome, Don Boudreau. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
I'm just going to jump right into it and start off talking about your newest book with Phil Graham, The Triumph of Economic Freedom, Debunking the Seven Great Myths of American Capitalism. And the reason I'm starting with this is because the big myth I find that is actually politically gets a lot of traction is the point that income inequality and poverty is exacerbated by capitalism, that it inherently is a bad system, and that it actually makes the poor poorer and the rich richer. I'd like to have you, if you give your views on that, that's a big topic, of course, yeah, and talk about the evidence that adds to the really intellectual understanding of the truth of that.
Whether you take a long-run historical perspective from the beginning of the Industrial Revolution 200, 250 years ago, or an even shorter perspective, there's simply no good evidence to back up this claim that capitalism makes the rich richer and the poor poorer. Capitalism makes everyone subject to it richer over time. Now, it makes some people, of course, richer than others. Jeff Bezos is a lot richer than you and me, but you and I are a hell of a lot richer than we would have been had we been born in the pre-industrial age, if we had survived or been born at all. And so if you look at the Industrial Revolution, one of the fallacies that we deal with in the book is that the riches of the industrialists, the early industrialists, were built by basically crushing the working class beneath the heels of these industrialists. And nothing could be further from the truth. By standards of today, working in a factory in Britain in 1800 was pretty bad. But by the standards of that era, it was pretty good. People were clamoring for those jobs. Wages were rising in Great Britain starting in the 19th century, even for working class Britons. They made a lot more money in the factories than they did on the farms, and life in the cities was a lot more interesting than it was out in the rural areas. More recently, if you look at the income distribution in the United States or in the Western world, what you find is, yes, there are increasingly high numbers of people with very, very magnificently large monetary levels of income. But that does not come at the expense of the poor. The Census Bureau, every year, I think, puts out a list of the percentage of American families in different income categories, and they adjust it for inflation. Less than 15,000, 15,000 to 25,000, on and on and on. And in a technical sense, the American middle class is disappearing. You hear this all the time. But it's not disappearing into the lower income groups. It's disappearing into the upper income groups.
Exactly. This topic that you're talking about, to me, is sort of under the umbrella of economic mobility. So there's this myth of, oh, the middle class is disappearing, somehow implying that everyone's getting poor, but it's quite the opposite. But the other part of this argument, and I'm a layman, I'm not an economist, so I'm asking questions that may seem obvious to you, but we talk about, you know, quintiles or quadrants or deciles of people in certain economic groups. They're not the same people.
That's right.
And isn't it true, or I'd like you to expand on the question, income mobility, economic class mobility in America, in a capitalist society, versus the other sort of socialistic societies? Because isn't that the point, is that you're not stuck, the opportunity for advancement? That's why people come to the United States, frankly.
That's exactly right. Income mobility in the U.S. across different income levels, quintiles, deciles, no matter how you measure it, whether you measure it individually, whether you measure it according to family, it's pretty high. Of course, there are some people who are born poor and stay poor. There are some people who are born rich and stay rich. But a shockingly large number of people who are born in the lowest decile or quintile at some point in their life wind up in the higher, in the highest level, and vice versa. And so I don't have the exact numbers off the top of my head, but in chapter 6, I think it is, in our book, or chapter 7, one of the final two chapters of the book, we have those data in there that are very encouraging about income mobility in the U.S. And all these data come from, you know, the U.S. Census Bureau, the Bureau of Labor Statistics. These are all just drawn right out of the publicly available data. Anyone who wants to look at them can do so. And they tell a pretty compelling story. You're exactly right. Income mobility in the U.S. is incredibly high compared to what people think it is. Of course, it's not perfect, but that's a ridiculous standard. It's very high compared to what it was in the pre-industrial age, when if you were born a peasant, you stayed a peasant. With very, very few exceptions.
Yeah, and by the way, people aren't equal. I mean, you know, that's sort of a verboten topic to say, but the reality is that it's a little bit strange to expect exactly equal outcomes when people are not equal. You know, I mean, and this applies to all walks of life, whether it's athletics, intellectual, entrepreneurial fields, whatever you want to say.
I wanted to be an NFL linebacker when I was young, but I was not born with the physical capacity.
I wasn't courageous enough to want that kind of job. I mean, I'm a little bit afraid of that. But yeah. You know, the other topic in rich versus poor, particularly, you know, we see a lot of this discussion going on, and we're going to talk about New York City and Mamdani's election and all that. But before we get to that, the concept of being poor in America, and I'm not denying that there are poor people in America, but the sort of lower income classes in the United States, that's not the same thing as poor when you go to, if you travel around enough and you go to places like India or China or most countries, frankly, the lower, you know, quartile of American living standard is not exactly poor in the sense of international poverty.
Nearly all Americans, even the poorest, have indoor plumbing. Most have air conditioning. Practically 100% have electrification in their homes. They're all vaccinated against measles and polio. They are well fed, despite what you hear. No American starves to death except by some bizarre chance. Yes, by the standards that you and I as middle class or upper middle class Americans are accustomed to, there are definitely poor people in the United States. And I don't mean, and you don't mean, to demean their position, but there's no question that materially they are far better off than they would have been 100 years ago, and better off than, as you say, a lot of people are today in other parts of the world that don't have the free market institutions that we've so long enjoyed. And, you know, and life expectancy of poor Americans is not as high as life expectancy of, you might know this better than I do, but life expectancy of poor Americans is very high by historical standards, not as high as life expectancy of wealthy Americans, but it's still well above the historical norm.
Mm-hmm. And of course, life expectancy is a different topic. I don't want to get into it. It's too complicated. But the reality is that the evaluation of life expectancy has been grossly oversimplified. There's all kinds of factors, including voluntary factors, that change the life expectancy statistic. And by the way, homicides and suicides, which are much higher in the United States, when you kill somebody who's young, you've changed the life expectancy quite a bit. And so if you have orders of magnitude higher homicide of young people, you're going to change overall life expectancy, but we won't get into that.
I've inadvertently gotten into a topic where you're the expert. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't want to pontificate. I do that enough, I think. I want to talk more about Hayek. I just, you know, I'm on this sort of campaign with myself to reread books that I read when I was too young to understand them. And to read books that are classics that help me understand the insanity of what we see today in so many parts of our world. And one of those books that I just recently reread is Hayek's classic, Road to Serfdom. And it's sort of amazing. It could have been written today. I mean, it's amazing. As you know, you are one of the world's Hayek experts. But I want to talk about free market economics. And the point here is that, and related to what's going on today, because, you know, we get all this clamor, anti-capitalism, anti-free markets, but there's a lot of case to be made that we don't have a lot of that going on today, because true free market economics is about competition and individualism, not direction by the state, whether it's literally the state or the federal government or whatever. And we see a lot of examples in policy today under President Trump, who's a capitalist, there's no question, but we have things like drug price caps, revenue sharing with private companies, state partial ownership of private companies. These are clear sort of violations of free markets and potentially invite broader economic controls.
Yeah,
I'd like to hear your thoughts on what's going on with that.
So when I was younger, I read Hayek since I was an undergraduate, and he influenced me a great deal. And the first book I read by Hayek, not surprisingly, was also The Road to Serfdom. And we can, if you want, talk more about the details of that book. I agree, it's very timely. It could have been written in 2025 or 2026. But when I was younger, I had the belief that the market was much more fragile than it really is. You know, you intervene a little bit, the thing's going to collapse. And one of the things in which I've changed my mind is that the market is more robust than a lot of people believe, and that I used to believe. Now, what I mean by that is, it can, you remember there's a little Timex commercial, that the Timex watch takes a licking and keeps on ticking. The market's kind of like that. You can abuse it, and it's so dynamic and so robust, it just keeps churning stuff out. Now,
why is that? Is that because Americans are entrepreneurial enough, or what is the source of that? Or we're heterogeneous enough of a population, or large enough?
I think you touched on the two most important things. Yes, we are an incredibly entrepreneurial a country. We take it for granted because we live in it. American entrepreneurship is off the charts high. And so that entrepreneurial drive, not just for the monetary profit, that's part of it, but just the urge to create, the urge to create a business and see the business through to growth and to innovate and to change the world through introducing new products and new production processes. Americans are full of that. You know, de Tocqueville he notices when he visited America 200 years ago. And so I think that's part of it. I do think the diversity of our population is also part of it. We get lots of different ideas, lots of different perspectives, and that enables us, when one idea fails, we can easily tap into some related different idea. So the market is very, very robust. I think the profit motive itself, the ability of people to, the drive for people to make a profit, compels them to overcome a lot of obstacles.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that also true, though, if I can interrupt again, that the climate, the regulatory climate allows it? You know, you can have people who want to do all kinds of entrepreneurial, independent, private business activity, but if it's so hyper-regulated, it's not going to be so trivial.
So this is another point. I mean, I spend much of my waking hours complaining about government involvement in the economy. But it's still the case, despite the increases in that involvement over the past several decades. It's still the case that we are largely a market-oriented economy. We don't have much in the way of price controls. There's free entry into most industries. We have employment at will. Contracts are still respected. I think the rule of law is still a thing. Profits are not taxed. I wish they would be taxed even less, but they're not taxed to the point of being confiscatory. And that the remaining large space of the free market in the United States enables it to keep churning out. Now, it would be even better if the regulatory burdens were even less, the tax burdens were even lower, and the things that you mentioned, for example, government taking partial ownership of equity shares in corporations, were not happening. I have no doubt that these things make the market perform worse than it otherwise would, but it still continues to churn out great amounts of material wealth for even the poorest Americans. But at some point, it won't be able to do that. If you abuse it too much, it's going to die.
Mm-hmm. So talking about, that there's not just policy, but there's Hayek, again, talked about a lot of things about the dangers of state ownership, of state intervening, of controlling the means of production, if you want to go to Marx. And he talked about sort of there's a hijacking of vocabulary. Okay. He talked about the words like freedom were taken over in these socialist movements, in these socialist economies. And here he was talking about, at some level, Nazi Germany, but he was talking about a lot of different things in that time and how the UK, England even, was going toward a sort of a socialist thing. There's this taking over vocabulary. It leads into what he also talked about is how these movements go. And he talked about how it's a propaganda. It's a means of propaganda that people end up wanting collectivism at the sacrifice of their own individual freedom because they're convinced that they're gaining somehow freedom. I mean, how does that relate to things today, particularly in our young people? We see a real, I think, a mischaracterization of what a free market economics is and capitalism, and that has political impact.
Yeah, it's not a hot take that if you can grab the good language, you've gone a long way to winning the ideological battle. Mamdani, you mentioned Mayor Mamdani earlier, but he famously said on his inauguration day that he was going to bring the warmth of collectivism. Now, this is just wonderful language. Who doesn't like warmth? This guy must be historically completely ignorant, given that collectivism has not delivered warmth. It's delivered tragedy and poverty and tyranny. But that's just one example of just using nice words. You mentioned the word freedom. I can't remember, Scott, if it was in The Road to Serfdom or somewhere else. It may have been in The Road to Serfdom. But Hayek explicitly mentioned somewhere his objection to Franklin Roosevelt's use of, in the four freedoms, and two of the four freedoms, freedom from want and freedom from, I can't remember the other bizarre freedom. And these are positive freedoms. And Hayek said, that's not what freedom is about. Freedom is to be used properly. The word means protection from the intrusions of the government. You're free to act as you choose, whenever you choose to act peacefully. You're not...
It's the freedom to satisfy the want. It's not it's the freedom from the want.
That's right. Not to be free of the want. Yeah. And so the Hayek has an essay called The Confusion of Language in Political Thought, and where he goes into this in great detail, and he details a lot of the different abuses of language. The word liberalism is one of them. Hayek fought all of his life against the capture of the word liberals by people we today call progressives, because you know the noble origin of that term was we were going to be liberated from the oppression of the state and tradition, and we're each free to pursue our own chosen goals as long as we do so peacefully. And that's the true liberal vision. That's the vision that Hayek spent his entire life attempting to make the case for. That's the case he makes in The Road to Serfdom. But the language is that the leftists use is disreputable. It's often wrong.
Yeah, I mean, and this is coupled with what again Hayek talked about, you know, 80 years ago, was ignorance. Mm-hmm. Okay, now, and here I'm going to invoke that in the people who voted for Mamdani, young people, the people who are, you know, the stereotype is the lower Manhattan young person walking around with their $8 latte who thinks that they're entitled to be able to buy a house in the West Village, you know, and if it's not, there's something wrong with the system. And that is coupled with the total ignorance about what happens when socialism and socialistic policies come in. And he talked about ignorance quite a bit as enabling this central planning, enabling what he didn't talk about socialism per se. He talked about it in terms of it's all the same and it's collectivism as opposed to individualism. You know, what are your thoughts on, you know, I hate to say it this way, but what has happened to our education or our system of information to young people, meaning people under 30, with a total lack of understanding of what the dangers of collective versus individual opportunity is? I mean,
it's not
very
just,
disheartening to me.
It is. It's not just that universities over the past 20 or 30 years have become more and more infected with these absurd, you know, group studies majors, black studies, women's studies, you know, all these grievance studies, and which are useless majors. They don't train you or educate you to do anything productive except to be. To tote around a grievance for all your life. I think it's even worse than that. The worst thing is we don't teach students to think anymore. And they're being more and more coddled in the university. I see it. I've been a college professor for nearly all my adult life. And I see it as time goes on. The coddling that the university administration gives to students today is a great deal more than it was even 15 years ago. Many, many more students get special disabilities dispensation. They need time and a half to take an exam. They can't take an exam in a room surrounded by other people because the noise will bother them. You know, and when you start coddling people in this way, they're not going to become good, responsible, productive, prudent citizens.
But I think we've also dropped the ball in the historical perspective.
Oh, for sure.
Of again, these sort of collectivist systems. In fact, Hayek specifically talked about how socialism, communism, democrat socialism, Marxism, these are all the same. And he explicitly says in the Road to Serfdom that they're actually the same in that they are all ultimately totalitarian systems.
Yeah.
And I think that the lack of historical knowledge of this, I don't understand it, but it's shocking how there is no knowledge and no comprehension of this.
Well, you and I, of course, are old enough to remember the Soviet Union, the Eastern Europe behind the Iron Curtain, the Berlin Wall, and we remember the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, how glorious those days were. In my mind, that just seems like yesterday. But I have to realize that my students now, they're 18, 19, 20, they weren't alive when that happened. And they, you know, no one, I try my colleagues at George Mason's economics department try, but we're a tiny group. And I know there are a handful of other people who try. The vast majority, I assume, it seems, of college professors, high school professors, they're not teaching this history. They're not teaching that socialism has an uninterrupted record of poverty and tyranny. There's no exception. You cannot point to a successful socialist experiment. You can point. Every country that has adopted free market principles has prospered, and there's been no tyranny. Yes, you get a little bit of poverty. You get some industrial accidents, of course. But the performance of the free economies compared to the collectivist economies, and you're right, whether they're socialist, Marxist, Maoist, doesn't matter what you call them. The performance of those two different economies is starkly different. And you don't have to be a genius to parse out to see those differences. And so this historical reality is simply not being taught sufficiently widely.
And this is so, it was shocking to me when I reread the book to realize that Hayek was talking about how in that era, in the UK, young people didn't know or were rejecting the liberal, the classical liberal here, philosophies of Lord Acton and Gladstone. They didn't know anything. The young people of that era, we're talking about 80 years ago, this is not new, this sort of hand-wringing that I'm doing about the lack of knowledge of young people. But it's happening again today, and I think... we're seeing the results of it, and the results of it are the election of people like Mamdani in New York City, the center of the world's capitalism, frankly. And I think that's very that's frightening to me.
But you know, Scott, I think it's even in a way it's even worse today. You're right. The people at Hayek wrote about 80 years ago. They had their own historical ignorance. It's even worse today. The young people in 1944, they didn't really yet have the Soviet experience and the Eastern European experience to point to and say, wow, look how bad it is. We have a lot more historical experience now. All of it showing the depredations and tyranny of socialism. And even with all this additional unambiguous information, today's young people are just as ignorant as they were 80 years ago. It really is a disgrace.
Mm-hmm. It's a failure, I think, of not just our universities. It's a failure, really a cultural failure, I think. Although I don't know the easy solution to it, except that we need people like you to keep teaching, but also trying through all the newly available mediums.
Yeah.
Like your Cafe Hayek blog. This has to be really emphasized. There's a complete lack of history, and it's ending up being interpreted in a grossly destructive way to start putting people in power that think that collectivist policies are the way to go. There's another aspect to central planning, and Hayek pointed this out too, and that is this idea that what he called scientists, what it really means is like technocrats being empowered and being the basis of policy to an extreme level. And we've seen it here, whether it's in my area of healthcare, but climate, all kind energy policy, and these things, these sort of what I'll call technocrats that are making policies that are devoid of common sense and the actual data when you look at the outcomes of these policies. As Milton Friedman said, the big problem is judging policies by their intent instead of their outcomes. What are your thoughts on how we've become a society and a governance that is more and more based on what we think of as objective, which is this technocrat or scientific so-called data?
Hayek became increasingly over his life convinced that at a high level, the real problem in modern society, or the real challenge that liberalism faced, was he called the abuse of science and reason. And science is a wonderful thing, right? But society is not a science project. Science can tell us what happens when, it can tell us about the facts of reality, about cause and effect. Science can't tell us how to make trade-offs. And people, if they worship science too much, they think that all we have to do is put some really intelligent, well-educated PhD technocrats in power in Washington or Brussels or wherever, and then they can tell us how to live. It's a scientific project. And of course they can't. And Scott, no one knows better than you. I mean, this was one of the great examples of this abuse happened during COVID. We were told to follow the science, and experts were going to tell us how to live, how we should make trade-offs about whether we should go outside or whether we should go out to a restaurant, whether we should wear masks or not. Science can tell us what the consequences might be of wearing a mask or not. Science can't tell us how we should make the trade-offs with these risks. And yet the attraction that people have of being guided by science, and this is something that people on the left are especially prone to. They think that science does have the answer to how we all should live, and then all we have to do is follow the instructions in the recipe, and we can be totaled off to some kind of earthly heaven. And that's just crazy. That is the road to serfdom.
Well, I mean, yeah, the over reliance on that, right or wrong on the data itself, does not include the moral and social ramifications of these actions. And right. One of the things that I don't know if it was de Tocqueville or Hayek or someone on that level said, but you can't have great men are virtuous men. Okay, great men and leaders are virtuous leaders. And you can't have a free society, a moral society, without taking into account those things. It's not just the data.
That's right.
Yes, we saw that massively during COVID, where children and poor people were sacrificed for the benefit of older people and the affluent class. And I don't want to go on too much about that because it's been said, and it's very disturbing to me, frankly, to see that is the United States, and I'm very concerned that it is not a lesson learned.
But you mentioned climate for a while. That's another example. We're told by the so-called experts that there is a correct level of carbon emissions. For example, there's no correct level of carbon emissions. They're all trade-offs. Thomas Sowell, one of his most famous statements, is there are no solutions, there are only trade-offs. And science can tell us what might happen if we make a trade-off in one way as opposed to another way. Science cannot tell us what the right trade-off is. That's for us as moral individuals to decide. So when we allow ourselves to become frightened by some climate scare, by some virus scare, by some foreign, by whatever scare someone comes up with, and then succumb to some scientists, people who pretend to be scientists usually, we sacrifice our freedom. And as I said, that's the road to serfdom. We're giving up our autonomy in the name of being ruled by experts who, again, in most cases, aren't really experts at all. But even if they were, it's not their business to tell us how to live.
Mm-hmm. And this goes into the topic of what Hayek talked about, and Milton Friedman too. Milton used the term, there's no such thing as a free lunch. Yeah. It sort of is an allusion to the reality that there are short-term enticements with interventionist policies, but ultimately you sacrifice quite a bit. And I think Hayek and Milton are talking about what I would call the moral courage to resist these sort of short-term inducements to give up freedom. Yeah. I wonder if this is something that concerns you also, that, you know, we see again, like people that demand interventionist policies, capping prices on rents, capping prices on items, giving money, redistributing money to people
forgiving
for the short term. There's a moral courage that you have to sort of resist that short term game. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Of course. And, you know, the unfortunately, a lot of people who seek, not all, there are exceptions, notable exceptions, but a lot of people who seek political power, they don't really have much of in the way of moral character. They just want to be in positions of power. So they will say and do whatever it takes to obtain political power. And one way to obtain political power is to promise to give this group a lot of, give your likely voters a lot of goodies. You take them from other people, and you don't see, the other people don't see that they're losing, because the group from which the goodies are taken are dispersed and spread out, and the group that receives the goodies are concentrated, and so the group that receives the goodies can easily bestow political benefit on their political benefactor. And in my view, people who do that, the politicians, they are in a very real way immoral. They are buying votes, they're buying political power by taking the property of innocent people and giving it to other people just to get those other people to vote for them and keep those politicians in power. And if you have enough of these immoral people running for office and being elected to office, at some point the system just breaks down. It can't withstand it. Fortunately, I think we do have enough people in government who do have some moral grounding and moral principles that keep the whole thing from collapsing. But at some point, if we lose more of the moral people, there won't be enough to maintain the moral standing that we need in order for a society to keep moving forward.
Right. And, you know, as we look at the politicians, again, yes, there are some good people in government, but I think that, and this is, again, something I want to relate back to Hayek, he talked about how these socialist tendencies back in pre-Nazi Germany in the 30s, I guess, there was a movement from both the left and the right that was anti-capitalism that talked about, you know, and it was sort of a nationalism move, but it was anti-capitalism, anti-individualism, solidarity, and almost like a class warfare sort of mentality. And it didn't come from one side. It came from both sides in Hayek's view, the left and the right. And I wonder if that's sort of happening today, there a little bit.
I think we see it. Some people call it the wishbone, the horseshoe theory that the left and the right meet. A lot of the things that President Trump is doing are good. Energy deregulation, tax cuts, financial market deregulation, all good. But his taking ownership shares, you mentioned earlier, ownership shares in private corporations, that is not good. Elizabeth Warren must be secretly cheering. You know, she doesn't like the fact that Trump's doing it, but it's a policy she likes. In my view, the tariffs, the protective tariffs, are horrible. And the interventions that we are now seeing increasingly being embraced by people on the political right are ones that have long been endorsed by people on the political left. And it's distressing that the kind of Ronald Reagan free market orientation of the Republican Party that was the dominant force in that party when you and I were young men, that seems, if not completely gone, it's certainly waning at the moment, and I find it distressing.
Yeah, I You know, I think that we're living in a time where the traditional party bounds have blurred quite a bit. And I don't care too much about the party bounds, but I do care about the policies and the results of the policies. You know, because one of the things that when you go down the pathway, and this is, again, a Hayekian sort of reference on the road to serfdom, you know, the pathway of increasing state intervention, even if you think, oh, in this case, it's good, in this case, it'll work, it's a pathway that ultimately ends up in coercion. It's a coercive policy. And, you know, this, again, it's very concerning that state coercion would be normalized over the essence of why free markets work in the whole sort of Milton Friedman statement on why free markets work is because it's a voluntary exchange, bi-directional. And if it's not benefiting both parties, they wouldn't voluntarily do it.
That's correct.
So, you know way more about this than I do. Like I say, I'm not an economist, but the basic premise of free market interactions is that it's voluntary and therefore deemed beneficial by the people engaging in the transaction.
Right. And those transactions, therefore, should enjoy a very strong presumption of legitimacy. It's a rebuttable presumption. Let's say national security concerns come into play, and so maybe some of them have to be overridden. But by and large, if adult individuals, choose to engage in what Robert Noza called consensual capitalist acts, we should presume that that is good for not only those individuals, but for society as a whole. Because if I allow you to engage in consensual capitalist acts, then you are morally obliged to allow me to engage in my own consensual capitalist acts. And because these exchanges are voluntary, we both gain. You know, one of the great things about a free market, and it's trite in a way when you hear it, but I think it's really important, and that is the ability of even the poorest person to say no. And the ability to say no gives even the richest person the incentive to try to better please the person who said no. Jeff Bezos is a lot richer than me, but I can say no to Jeff Bezos and so can you. I say, no, I don't want to buy your Amazon product. And if I say no, he's got an incentive to try to serve me better.
Right. As long as there's enough competition and choice, which is that's the role of, to me, that's a critical role of policy, is to ensure that individuals have competition and choice, therefore, available for them. Because once you eliminate that, it's over.
You're exactly right. Economic competition is extremely, extremely important. But when I was a young economist, I spent many years studying economic history and competition and competition policy, antitrust, as we call it in America, of course. And one of the things that I learned, not just from my own personal research, but from talking to scholars a lot better and more senior than me, is, again, just how robust the market economy is. A lot of the firms that have come down to us in history as being monopolists and consumers allegedly were helpless in the face of them, that's all a myth. Standard Oil, for example, John D. Rockefeller Standard Oil Company, it had a huge share of the market. It never had monopoly power. It never had the ability to raise prices and harm consumers. What you see happened is, as Standard's market share went up, the prices of kerosene, which was the main product that Standard sold, kept going down and down and down. And I think that's true even today in a lot of the companies that people fear are a behemoth monopolists. There's no doubt that if government gives a company special privilege, there are many different ways to do that, that mutes the competitive pressures and that enables the company to take advantage of consumers and workers. But as long as it's free entry into an industry, I'm quite confident that consumers, that's the best way to protect consumers from any kind of economic power.
Mm-hmm. So we'll finish up with the question, sort of, what's your general feeling? Your, not a literal prediction, but what do you think? Are we moving toward a more status-controlled economy? Or, you know, because we have sort of a mixed bag of things going on in the current administration. And again, temporarily or short-term things can be, quote, successful, but it's not clear, are we inviting a more centralized socialist economy? Are we watching that unfold in the United States? And I'm also saying that looking at the election of the New York City mayor, I'm looking at some of the very visible politicians railing against capitalism in the news all the time. Are we really watching that unfold here, or what do you think's happening?
Yeah, you know, I live in Virginia. Of course, Virginia was the gubernatorial election this past fall was one of the ones that had been trumpeted as significant. And the person who won, Abigail Spanberger, ran as a centrist. But those of us who know better know that she's not a centrist. And sure enough, she and the Republican, excuse me, the Democratic majorities of the Virginia General Assembly are not governing as centrists. They're trying to impose radical left policies. And there are, and of course, Mamdani, to his credit, doesn't run away from the term socialist. He's a proud socialist, democratic socialist. And a lot of what the Trump administration is doing, I think, is inexcusable. Again, a lot of what they're doing is fine, but a lot of what they're doing is inexcusable. And so I think the answer to your question, Scott, is if you look at the overall trend, yes, we are moving in the United States now almost every day closer and closer to a more command and control, centralized, authoritarian economy. I don't think we've gone so far yet that we can't retreat without having a lot of damage done. I think that's still possible. But at some point, again, we keep referring to Hayek's road to serfdom. Some point you go far enough down that road and retreat doesn't become possible. The amount of destruction that is unleashed becomes too great to undo. Again, I don't think we're there yet, but in terms of the direction that we're moving in now, I think it's unambiguously the case that we're becoming much more interventionist, indeed, in some cases, downright socialist.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the saving graces at this point in time, anyway, is our sort of, I'll say, quasi-federalist system, because I don't think it's as federalist as people think. But on the other hand, there is a lot of opportunity for at least a percentage of people to relocate their businesses. And I think we do see the flight out of the New York and
California,
other places, out of California into Texas, into Florida, where there's less regulation and frankly more freedom. So I think that's on the positive side of change of what's happening, but it remains to be seen. I'm very concerned.
Yeah, I think that, you know, some data were just released past day or two to confirm just what you said, that the population movement from blue states into red states, as they're now called, is continuing. My brother moved from California, where he lived for 35 years, to Tennessee a few years ago, and I visited him a couple of years ago, and he lives just north of Nashville, and I was driving around, and I saw a sign in a yard in a Nashville home. It had a picture of Gavin Newsom on it, and it said, "Congratulations, Gavin Newsom, Realtor of the Year." It was a joke that he drove all these people out of California into Tennessee.
Exactly.
And that's happening. And so you're exactly right. That ability to move from jurisdiction to jurisdiction is, and that maybe is also one of the reasons why the market in the United States does, as I said earlier, continue to remain robust enough to keep on keeping on.
Right. I mean, the sort of buffering capacity, not just of the different branches of government, but the states has the opportunity to really be the source of your regulation as opposed to the federal government. And this, each state, at least for now, there's enough difference so that businesses particularly, but people secondarily can move. Although, you know, it is, I don't want to fall into this so-called elitist trap of thinking that everybody can just have the freedom to just move to a better state, different state. Most people don't have a life like that.
You don't need everyone to have that ability. If the people who are rich and own businesses, I mean, they are the ones who are able to move. And those are the ones that the state governments want most to keep. And so,
yep, true.
And so precisely trying to keep those people there puts a, you know, not a complete constraint, but a huge constraint on them. And one other thing, we talked earlier about education and, you know, what's happening to young people. We see now at the state level a lot of, in my view, really good movement toward more and more school choice at state and local levels. And maybe that is planting the seed for a long-run revival of, you know, American education and good historical knowledge that we don't see evident today.
Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the other books I'm reading, rereading, is Democracy in America by de Tocqueville. And, you know, one of the things that strikes me about his observations and his enthusiasm about the United States system, it was a different country. Okay. I mean, I, you know, again, don't want to be too negative, but the reality was he was very excited about the idea and the observation that Americans were so patriotic and so excited to be so involved in their democracy, their form of democracy, that he goes on and on about the virtues of Americans, even though he disparages.
Optimistic, yeah.
Optimistic, and he does say, basically, we may not be the brightest, but we're you know, he sort of and ironically talking about it a little bit, that we may not be the brightest, we may not do things by having the best people in charge, but we're all in because we're free. So that's true, and let's hope the value of freedom. You know, the one thing I have learned from my economist friends at Hoover is that economic freedom is essential to all other freedom. Because as Hayek said, again, it's not the money that you get from your financial success. It's the economic freedom to do what you want because you have that yeah. wealth accumulation. And that goes to every other part of your life, the freedom to choose, whether it's education or your career or anything else, what you do with your children. And so, yes, it is true. I have come to understand that economics is central to everything, even though I used to laugh at my economist friends for thinking that. Anyway, I will end on that note, Don. Thank you very much for the time. It's a pleasure to chat, and I hope I can have you back on again.
Likewise, Scott, I'd be delighted.
Thank you again. Thank you for listening to The Independent with Scott Atlas. If you want to find out more about today's guest, Don Boudreau, follow his work at the Mercatus Center of George Mason University and his very popular Substack, the economics blog called Cafe Hayek. And don't forget, subscribe to this show on YouTube, Spotify, and anywhere else you're listening to podcasts right now, and I'll see you next time.